Good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. It is April 2021, and April is Parkinson's Awareness Month. So on this episode of Health Matters, we will be talking about Parkinson's disease, as well as a related movement disorder called essential tremor. Approximately 60,000 Americans are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease every year. More than 10 million people worldwide are living with Parkinson's, and the latest study shows that Parkinson's disease numbers are actually increasing. Tonight, we are very honored and privileged to be joined by Dr. Jessica Wilden. She is a neurosurgeon at Tri-State Neurosurgery, part of the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as Wendy Taylor Neurosurgery Nurse Practitioner. Dr. Wilden, welcome back to Health Matters.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you again. And Wendy, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you guys being on, and we appreciate you listening. You can call with questions or comments. The number here tonight is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. All right, easiest question of the night, Dr. Wilden, goes to you. What causes Parkinson's disease?
Super easy question, no problem. So Parkinson's, if we start at the very base of what it is bad signaling from the brain to the body. And I think this is commonly misunderstood as potentially just being tremor or muscle weakness. Parkinson's, at its very essence, is the brain not sending the correct signals to the muscles of the body. And when that happens, you get tremors, but you also get global slowness, global stiffness, difficulty maintaining your posture, and falls. And the reason for this is that the brain area, and it's a fancy name, but the brain area called the substantia nigra, it's an area in the brainstem, gets low on the chemical dopamine. We don't know exactly why dopamine cells die off in people with Parkinson's, but we do know that there are certain genes and certain environmental exposures that predispose you to cell death of the dopamine neurons. Neuron is just another name for a brain cell.
So loss of neuronal input of dopamine from the substantia nigra, part of the brain, that's part of the brain stem. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about, you know, the causes of Parkinson's. Do we know what the risk factors are?
Yeah.
Parkinson's disease?
We definitely get on the question, like, you know, who gets Parkinson's disease? And the short answer is it can be anyone. Parkinson's has been diagnosed in nearly all age groups, gender, ethnicity, and races. In general, it's about 1.5 times more common in men than women, and it's more common in older people than younger people. The average age of Parkinson's diagnosis is about 60 years old, although there is a subset of Parkinson's called young onset PD that describes patients who develop symptoms as early as their 30s and 40s. Known risk factors include exposure to toxins, and that includes manganese, like that used in mining and welding, as well as carbon monoxide and pesticides, and that includes paraquat, permethrin, and Agent Orange. And that's why the VA system has recognized formally that exposure to Agent Orange is a risk factor for Parkinson's disease and will cover veterans' care if they have Parkinson's now and had a significant exposure to Agent Orange.
Wendy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. As a nurse practitioner, what's your role that you play in terms of the treatment of these patients?
So I guess what my role is whenever the patients come in, I make sure that a thorough history is completed on them, because that's going to tell us whether or not this patient actually has essential tremor versus Parkinson based on what they are telling us, and then we'll do a full body assessment and assess their motor and non-motor movements and kind of go from there and say, okay, do we want to start treatment? Are you already on treatment? Are you tolerating it?
And so I understand there are some things that may, you know, look like Parkinson's disease that could be, you know, other diagnoses. So taking a thorough history by a specialist sounds like it's pretty important.
Exactly. I think a lot of times even subtle hints from patients saying, I lost my smell about 10 years ago, or I sweat a lot. Those help us cue in onto what is actually going on with them.
And in terms of the medication history, is it important for our listeners to know out there that there are certain medications that maybe you might hear about that the patients have been taking for a long period of time? Let's just say, for example, some, you know, drugs used to treat, you know, severe episodes of depression or psychosis, or even drugs that are used for things like chronic nausea and things along those lines that can cause, you know, problems with Parkinson's. Drug-induced Parkinson's,
exactly.
I guess, is what I'm sort of getting at. How important is that whenever you take the history?
Well, I think Dr. Woldage, she brings up a good point about neuroleptic PD. But yeah, as far as medications, there's medications for the psychosis that you were referring to. It's a newer medication that does a really good job at handling these issues for them.
Yeah, there are two different things I just want to inject, because I think we're talking about two separate topics. So neuroleptic Parkinson's, which Wendy is trained to kind of recognize and take a history on, is drug-induced Parkinsonism. So not everything that we see that looks like Parkinson's is due to low dopamine. Some of it is what we call Parkinson's look-alike, or Parkinsonism. Certain drugs that block dopamine, like Haldol, Geodon, Abilify, and sometimes even things like lithium or Depakote, if they're used at high doses for many years, can cause someone to look like a Parkinson's patient because of their dopamine blocking activity. So in that case, we need to assess, can we work with your psychiatrist to get you off some of these medicines so that this Parkinson's type picture will resolve? Now, in terms of having Parkinson's and getting psychosis, that is also a thing that happens. And Wendy is referring to a very new drug in the last 2 years called Nuplazid that is the first FDA-approved drug to treat psychosis that is a part of Parkinson's disease. And that was a huge breakthrough for a lot of people, because people can get hallucinations in Parkinson's disease, and it can be very scary for people. And this is the first FDA-approved drug specifically to suppress that.
Excellent information. This is Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host this evening as we discuss the neurological disorder known as Parkinson's disease. You can call us with questions about this topic if you have questions, or you can call with a comment. That number to call is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Willard, we talked about, you know, some of the causes of Parkinson's disease as well as risk factors. Some of the earliest symptoms that Wendy mentioned were, you know, issues with smell and things along those mm-hmm. lines. What are some of the symptoms that you look for when you're trying to distinguish Parkinsonism from other forms of neurological problems that can result in maybe some of the similar symptoms? And maybe what are those?
Sure.
That classic triad of symptoms. I don't know if we've gone through that yet.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the first thing to understand for listeners is definitely understand that Parkinson's is not just tremor. And for those Parkinson's patients out there who have tremor and are rolling their eyes like, oh my gosh, I experience so much more than just tremor, but that's all people see, this comment is for you. Parkinson's disease affects all areas of the brain when the dopamine is low. So you can get both what we call motor symptoms, which classically are slowness, stiffness, and tremor, but you can also get non-motor symptoms. You can get depression, anxiety, inflexibility, irritability, constipation, falling, apathy, withdrawal from your friends and family. These are all things that can relate to Parkinson's, and Parkinson's is not only tremor. And in addition, you can have a different type of Parkinson's called akinetic rigid, where you have no tremor at all. You're just slow and stiff. And sometimes I think that subgroup gets overlooked because they don't have tremor. And maybe someone says, well, you're just old, just deal with it. And yet they're not just normal aging. They actually have the slowness and stiffness form of Parkinson's disease.
Let's go ahead and go to our first caller of the evening. We have Miriam from Shreveport. Miriam, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi. I was wondering if there was any relation between ADHD medicine and Parkinson's. I often can have tremors due to my medication, and I know that's not the only thing, but I was just wondering if there's been any research on that.
Great question, Miriam. Dr. Wilden, you know, he's mentioning ADHD medications. Miriam, can you, if you don't mind, can you tell us specifically which ADHD medication that you take or that you're referring to?
Vyvanse.
Okay, yeah. So I can tell you that we do hear that Ritalin, Vyvanse, and stimulants in general at high doses can lead to shakiness or tremor. And, you know, it just become, and we do see that in our clinic. We also see it again with valproic acid. We see it with lithium as well, where people get very shaky. And, you know, if you're using just an over-the-counter stimulant, like you're taking caffeine pills or drinking a ton of soda or coffee, you can also get shaky and have some tremors. And, you know, it is a known side effect. But if you're benefiting from the medicine from a mental or physical standpoint and the tremors are minimal, then that can be an acceptable trade-off for some people. On the other hand, if the tremors are bothersome and people are mentioning them to you, it might be a good time to discuss with your provider, is there a change we can make? Or maybe could we use two different medicines in combination at an overall lower dose each to avoid side effects and get the same benefit?
Okay, awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Sure.
Miriam, are you still there?
I am, yes.
If you don't mind, just as a follow-up, is the tremor that you notice, is it there whenever you're not using your hands or arms?
Yes, it is.
So it is. So that's what we call resting tremor. What about if you, let's say, if you try to thread a needle or do something, you know, that's what we call fine motor?
Yes.
You notice that the tremor increases with those sorts of things?
I don't know if it increases, but I definitely notice it more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any trouble, like sort of, you know, maybe spilling liquids when you're, you know, transferring liquids from container to container, or changes in your handwriting?
No. I've always had pretty bad handwriting. So, no.
Any family history of tremors that got worse with age?
No.
No first degree real. Okay, well, hopefully this information's been helpful for you. We really appreciate you calling into Health Matters tonight.
Yeah, great. Thank you guys so much.
No problem.
You know, as you know, Dr. Wilden, you know, essential tremor is something that people get, but it's highly sensitive, you know, to our natural stimulants. You know,
yeah,
people who have sort of incipient, you know, familial tremor, they'll talk about they can't drink coffee, or if they've lost sleep, any sort of hyperadrenergic state.
Right.
They're really shaken off the page, so to speak. So we're going to get to essential tremor a little bit later in the show. Let's go ahead and take our next call. Thank you. We have Diane from Graceland, Texas. Diane, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for taking my call. My husband has been diagnosed with Parkinson. I want to know if it can turn into Parkinson.
What do you mean by he's been diagnosed with Parkinsonism? Tell us a little bit more about the symptoms.
He's got tremors and They said it's as part of the medication he was on. And we were just wondering if it could advance to Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Legs and everything.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, if you've been diagnosed with drug-induced Parkinsonism and the offending drug has been stopped, for instance, let's just say you had been maintained on Haldol or lithium for some years and then it was ultimately stopped, the first thing to know about drug-induced Parkinsonism is that it can take a few years to resolve. So you might stop the drug, and it might be a year or two before the symptoms that the drug caused fully wash out. Now, not to my knowledge, can drugs cause permanent damage, at least not those types of drugs, to the dopamine neurons. But every now and again, you might have more than one thing going on. If resting tremor, slowness, and stiffness does not resolve after stopping the drug, then it could be an indication that you actually have idiopathic, true Parkinson's disease. And there are some tests that we can do to sort that out, including brain scans and a full physical exam.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your help.
Thank you so much for calling us tonight on Health Matters. Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We're discussing Parkinson's disease tonight. The number for any questions or comments that you might have is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Our guests tonight are Dr. Jessica Wilden, neurosurgeon at Tri-State Neurosurgery, as well as nurse practitioner Wendy Taylor. Wendy, I understand, you know, from we were talking before the show that you have a personal history with Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease that you wanted to share a little bit about with regards to our listeners tonight.
Yeah, sure. So my stepfather, Clifford Robinson, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I guess, 20-plus years ago. First symptoms I probably saw when I was about 15. Obviously then, I had no idea you know, that it was Parkinson's, but he had this weird little neck thing he would do. Now I know it was dyskinesia, you know, we just didn't know. He'd also have his little foot kind of turn into the side. Mm-hmm. Dystonia, another, you know, symptom of it. And when he was finally diagnosed, by the time he had been diagnosed, he had diagnosed by tremor. That's, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. a common.
So those were some of the first symptoms that mm-hmm. were noticed, and what happened with regards to his treatment? How did the treatment work for him?
Well, it was kind of hit or miss. So
with medications?
Yeah, with medications, because at that time there wasn't somebody here locally yet that could really manage his care. He did eventually have the deep brain stimulator. And even after he, you know, was a little bit immobile, had some issues walking, and, you know, luckily Dr. Bolden actually came to our community, I guess it was about 2012, mm-hmm. 2013, she came in, and I mean, it was like, oh, you've got to see my stepdad. You've got to, you know, take care of him. And, man, when she did, I think he came in. He may have been using a cane or even on a walker at that time, but when he left, he didn't need those things. He was walking. He was able to do things, you know, making it took a little while, you know, about a year or so to kind of tweak the system, but making birdhouses, doing things that he loved, you know, making little knives, you know, a man with Parkinson's making knives. That sounds a little scary. Not for him, not after surgery. So it ended up being a really good thing for him.
Well, that's amazing. How long has he had the stimulator
for now? Oh, gosh. Since actually 2012. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so right. That's yeah. Nine years now.
Yeah.
That's a great outcome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Does he need any medications at all now for his Parkinson's?
No.
No.
He takes none.
So
yeah.
He's medication free.
Mm-hmm. And that's not always the case. But
yeah.
but Cliff, yeah.
He did very well.
He's a great guy. Yeah.
How old was he when he first began to have symptoms of it?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so now I'm going to reveal my age. So if I was 15...
That's a while ago.
He was 40. I guess he was young onset.
Yeah.
He was young onset Parkinson's. Yeah, 40, 45. Yeah.
And he's had a stimulator for about 9 years. That's a great outcome. Dr. Wilden, do you see stimulation of the systems that you are working with work better in some types of Parkinsonism or Parkinson disease compared to others?
Yeah, sure. So that's a good question. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit to clarify that we're not just neurosurgery clinic. We are a movement disorder clinic. So Wendy, myself, and we're bringing on a new nurse practitioner, Lori, next month. But we do medical as well as surgical management for movement disorders, including Parkinson's, essential tremor, and dystonia. So we don't always use the knife as a solution for you, just in case you're scared of us. Don't be. We do medical management. We do physical therapy, speech therapy. We refer out for Botox. And then we also use surgery as a tool. Surgery is best used as you go from early to moderate Parkinson's. A lot of people consider surgery an end-stage therapy, and it is not. It has not been since about 2016. The FDA changed its labeling based on data that was coming out that demonstrated that the deep brain stimulator could hold Parkinson's at bay very well, but did better if you had it earlier in the course of the disease. And I think that's a huge misconception out there, that you don't need to wait 20 years to get it. If you've had Parkinson's for just 4 years and you are taking medicine more than 3 times a day because it is wearing off for you, then you're a candidate for surgery. And I really encourage any patient out there who is taking medicine more than 3 times a day and feels it wearing off to contact us so that we can give them the information that they have a right to about using this tool earlier in their disease to get a better longer-term outcome.
From the standpoint of disease progression, have we began to understand that the deep brain stimulator actually impacts disease progression?
Yeah, that's another great question that is under active investigation. And I do believe the results out of the multi-center Vanderbilt Ren trial will end up changing the labeling again. What they've shown in the Vanderbilt trial is that when people were tested several years off DBS, they had progressed less than a control group. It's still very preliminary, and we cannot state that deep brain stimulation delays progression. But what we can state is that people that have the deep brain stimulator have a longer, more sustained quality of life compared to their medicine-only cohorts. And I think that really makes sense because surgery doesn't preclude medicine. It's an additive tool. So, of course, in a disease where there is no cure as of yet, if you're using two tools instead of just one tool to manage it, you're going to do better long term. And that is what has been consistently shown. So I think personally, and I'm not an objective viewpoint, but I think surgery is underutilized, and many people are candidates for it much earlier and could get a better quality longer. With the third major factor being exercise. People that exercise intensely from the very start of Parkinson's will do better long term.
From the standpoint of surgery, could you just, remind our listeners what is the goal of surgery? What are you actually attempting to accomplish with surgery for Parkinson's disease?
Sure. So if we come all the way back to the beginning of the show where we talked about the brain not communicating well with the body, the deep brain stimulator acts as a pacemaker to correct the signals that the brain is sending to the body. So you can think of Parkinson's as sort of a brain arrhythmia, like the atrial fibrillation of the brain. And the deep brain stimulator is a pacemaker. It's going to repace the brain to a more normal signal, which then sends a more normal signal down to the muscle. And in that way, the deep brain stimulator improves tremor. It can improve your general mobility. It can improve slowness and stiffness, and like the ability to golf, the ability to get out of bed, the ability to fix your own meals, to shave. All of those motor things may get 60%+ better after surgery because the signaling from the brain is better to the body.
You know, the symptoms that I think Wendy mentioned, you know, some of the autonomic symptoms that accompany Parkinson's disease, such as abnormal sweating, mm-hmm. you know, orthostatic hypotension, which is mm-hmm. fainting, you know, problems also with, you know, the mesolimbic system, right? So mm-hmm. the depression and, yeah. and issues with regards to behavior. Have you noticed that patients have benefits with regards to the other systems? Other systems that are involved with Parkinson's as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's why we are a multidisciplinary clinic. So that means we use a lot of different tools, not just surgery. Surgery at its base is really a motor therapy. It's not necessarily going to improve mood directly or going to improve swallowing directly. That being said, what we can do with surgery is make you more mobile, and then you can get into things like speech therapy, like exercise, that can actually have sustained long-term benefits on some of your non-motor symptoms. We routinely find that our patients that exercise more, especially in a group setting, have better mood, have less depression, have just better overall functioning emotionally and socially. And yet, if you can't move because you're so stiff, it's very hard for you to enter into those things that might help some of those other symptoms. And so surgery is really another tool to get you into more mainstream exercise, counseling, group support, whatever it is that could help you.
So multidisciplinary treatment is still very much in-
Absolutely.
An important part of treatment.
That's the way to go. Like I tell everybody, don't ask me to tweak your DBS if you're not exercising. It's a two-way street here. I can help you move more with the DBS, but you got to help yourself by exercising and getting out there, not being afraid of life.
Absolutely. Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio. We're discussing Parkinson's disease tonight. The number for any questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Wilden, from the standpoint of going back to, you know, some of the questions that people had earlier with mm-hmm. regard to do certain conditions progress to Parkinsonism, mm-hmm. and we know there are a number of genetic issues that are in play mm-hmm. with regards to Parkinsonism. Are you recommending or referring at all for genetic testing for patients or maybe their family members with Parkinson's?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the short answer is no, we don't do routine genetic testing because it's not a straightforward genetic disease. Parkinson's develops due to a variety of factors. You might have some genetic predisposition, maybe in your remote family, but then you might have also had an exposure like Agent Orange or pesticides, etc., that triggered it. So that's not a straightforward inherited disease, like, for instance, Huntington's chorea is a different movement disorder. Genetic testing, though, can be available through some of the Parkinson's foundations for free. If you're interested in signing up for a clinical trial, I believe there is one being run right now, I believe from the Parkinson's Foundation, where, you know, a company is, if you're interested in entering the study, the company will pay for genetic testing just so they can start to get information about the genetic links of Parkinson's. So there are definitely national resources that you can look up and trials that you can join that will pay for your genetic testing. But as a matter of course, most insurances and Medicare do not pay for it because it's considered not necessary because it will not change the course of the disease.
And so for our listeners out there, if they have someone who has a family history with Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease, should they be worried about detection of Parkinson's at an early stage?
Yeah, again, it's a very different disease than something like Huntington's, which is clearly passed down in families. Not Parkinson's is not a direct inherited disease. It's more like what we would call a perfect storm of your environmental exposures and your genetic makeup. We do not tell people that they need any additional testing, but surely if you notice symptoms as you are aging that are compatible with something that you saw in a family member maybe growing up, then we do encourage you to see a movement disorder specialist. There are a few forms of genetic Parkinsonism. LARC gene is one of them. And It's rare, but probably about 10 to 15% of presentations. So if you did have a family member, an immediate family member that had it, and you feel like you're developing the same symptoms, we would simply encourage you to see a movement disorder specialist.
Excellent information. Again, the number for questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502. And our discussion topic tonight is Parkinson's disease. Wendy, I understand you go through, you know, a number of the medications that patients are trying when they come to the clinic. Let's talk a little bit about the medical therapy of Parkinsonism and Parkinson's disease with regards to, you know, the main treatment, I understand, remains a drug called levodopa, correct?
Levodopa, carbidopa, yes. So typically that is our, you know, go-to if they've never tried medication before. We will start them on a very low dose. We like to go low and slow initially because a lot of times it's not well tolerated initially. But the mainstay treatment is called levodopa. It's over 50 years old. So if it's not broken, don't fix it, right? But so you use that. So again, what are we replacing? We're replacing the dopamine that they're lacking with the levodopa. It's a synthetic form. Dopamine itself can't get into the brain without a carrier. And so that's why you've got it paired up together, the carbidopa, levodopa. It carries it into the brain. It's very important, though, whenever we're, you know, prescribing these new medications to patients that they understand, it works best on an empty stomach, okay? Protein and levodopa, they actually compete for the same receptor. Protein's going to win every time. So we really encourage, you know, hey, right timing, you know, with your other meals and medications and stuff, so that way they can get more therapeutic response from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. I think that's why we get some hit or miss responses to medicine sometimes, is that these meds, it's super important to take them as instructed, because if you're like taking them with a boost, which might be good for your muscle development, you may not be getting the most bang for your buck. And so that is something Wendy spends a lot of time on education about, is how to take the medicine correctly, because the tool is only as good as you know how to use it. And what Wendy was saying about not being tolerated. So Sinemet, that's the Latin name, the brand name for carbidopa, levodopa. And Cine actually stands for nausea and vomiting in Latin. So you can probably all guess what the major side effect of it is. So nausea and vomiting with dopamine is fairly common. Levodopa is a little better tolerated with carbidopa, but for that reason, we start low and slow. You may not feel like it's helping your symptoms for the first few weeks, and that's okay. When Wendy starts you on a medicine, the goal is simply to tolerate it. And then as we come into a few months of tolerating it, we're going to ramp it up to a level that can work for your symptoms. So it is a little bit of a marathon, and there's never a good quick fix to probably any problem out there. But that's why we're going to go low and slow, is that we want you to be able to tolerate it from a GI perspective, which traditionally was the major factor in people having difficulty with this drug.
And so levodopa, it's the you know, neurotransmitter, if you will. It's the
it's the dopamine
compound that's released by those nerve cells in the substantia nigra, going into the, you know, globus pallidus, that part of the brain that stimulates to move correctly.
Yep.
And so we're replacing that. So it's hormone replacement therapy for lack of
neurotransmitter
replacement therapy. Yep. That is right. And it is called dopamine replacement therapy. So if you have access to your written chart or a portal and you see DRT referred to your case, that's the acronym for it, is dopamine replacement therapy.
And so getting, you know, into that, what's the difference between replacing dopamine and sort of mimicking dopamine and stimulating the dopamine receptor with a drug that's not levodopa, like a dopamine agonist? I understand there are a number of those treatments out there as well that are.
Yes.
What's the difference, and what sort of symptom complex would you use one for as opposed to the other?
Right. So there are several classes. So the whole goal of all medicine for Parkinson's is to enhance dopamine in the brain. So you've got a couple of options. You can, like, levodopa is just giving you dopamine outright. There are drugs that mimic dopamine and will just stimulate the receptors called dopamine agonist. There are enzymes that are given with dopamine or levodopa to prevent its breakdown. Those are all different ways to kind of increase dopamine in the brain. Dopamine agonists have been extensively studied. They include the meds Mirapex and Requip to see if they would be better for not causing dyskinesias or wearing off. And that gets a little deep because those are some medicine complications that we see. Because a lot of people think, oh, well, this is just a med like the diabetes. You know, I can take a pill for it. No, not bad. The problem is, with medicine, we run into certain complications over time. And I know complication is more often a word associated with surgery, but complications can occur with medicine too. So when you use levodopa for a long time, you can get what's called wearing off. And that means that maybe the levodopa used to work an hour to 5 hours, and now you feel like it barely works 10 to 20 minutes. Okay? You feel like the same dose is now working for a shorter period of time, and then it wears off. And you get slow again. So you just have to keep taking it more and more frequently or at a higher and higher dose to have an effect. And so that's one complication. And the other is called dyskinesia. And dyskinesia is basically abnormal movement induced by dopamine when it's delivered sort of as a bolus from your stomach. So dyskinesia are the movements that Michael J. Fox has, and those are actually not a primary part of most Parkinson's. They are a medicine side effect from the big doses that you're taking. So you get into kind of a feast or famine situation where you either are too slow or you move too much, and you never really have normal movement sustained. And that's the problem with medicine only. And that's why we introduce surgery as another tool to medicine to help even that out. There was a lot of hope that the dopamine agonist would have less wearing off and less dyskinesia versus levodopa or Sinemet, but that did not really pan out in the literature. And to date, the pendulum is kind of swinging away from dopamine agonist, I think, because we're seeing a lot of almost addictive type side effects with those drugs at high doses. So when we use dopamine agonist in our clinic, we tend to use them at a low to medium dose. It's rare that we'll push them super high because it has been noted now that about 30 to 35% of people long term on high dose dopamine agonist will almost develop an opioid like dependence on them. And we don't want to compound your Parkinson's with another problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a number of, you know, issues I think are at play there. You know, dopamine stimulation is the final common pathway for the nucleus accumbens to release.
It's the happiness chemical.
Yeah, to release those good feelings. Mm-hmm. And then patients, you know, Wendy, how often do patients complain about moving too much?
Actually, we get that quite a bit. Quite a bit. So, and that's, we typically will see it after surgery, and we start slowly tapering off that medication to get them to calm down some. And then we have patients that we, you know, manage medically, and they've, you know, previously before they got to us been severely overtreated. And it's, can be a little bit of a nightmare, but once we get them in, we can get them to a happy spot. Yeah.
And, you know, Dr. Wilden, there are other neurotransmitters that are involved in Parkinson's, such as, you know, acetylcholine, as well as ways to inhibit dopamine breakdown and things along those lines.
Right.
Are these drugs still in common usage with regards to the treatment of Parkinson's disease pharmacologically?
Sometimes. It depends on what we're treating. Drugs that enhance acetylcholine, which is kind of the thinking chemical. If dopamine's the happiness chemical, acetylcholine's like what helps us be smart. And if you're having some memory difficulty, we might start you on something that might enhance acetylcholine. If you have depression, we might start you on something that promotes serotonin, which is similar to dopamine, and as far as they're both kind of the happiness chemicals. And so we may not want to just hit you with all dopamine medicine. We may use a little bit of serotonin promoting medicine, like in the form of an antidepressant, to help maybe with mood or irritability as well. So it just really depends on your particular complex of symptoms. I think something important to recognize with dyskinesia, wearing off, should you have surgery? Do you need a different medicine? All Parkinson's patients are different. Like, they say, oh, if you've seen one Parkinson's patient, you've seen one Parkinson's patient. So I think what Wendy and Lori and I try and focus on in the clinic is individualized care, because everybody will be slightly different. And if you go to a support group, you might find something in common with some people, and you might find that everyone is their own little version of Parkinson's. And so it really is a specialist realm. I really encourage you to seek specialty care if you do have one of these disorders, because they get pretty complicated pretty fast in terms of management.
Speaking of specialized care, our specialty that we're discussing tonight is Parkinson's disease. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host, and our guests tonight are Dr. Jessica Wilden, neurosurgeon at Tri-State Neurosurgery, as well as Wendy Taylor, neurosurgery nurse practitioner. The number for any questions or comments about this topic tonight is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Again, the number is 1-800-552-8502. We've had a number of calls tonight, really, really good questions about this really important topic. You know, April is the beginning of spring, but it's also Parkinson Awareness Month. So this episode of Health Matters tonight, we are discussing this is the disorder known as Parkinson's disease, as well as Parkinsonism, which can be caused by things in addition to the neurodegenerative disease known as Parkinson's disease. Before we wrap up with Parkinson's disease, Dr. Wilden, anything that you're reading in the literature that's currently being published that is new and exciting for us to look forward to going forward?
Well, I think, you know, again, I think the pendulum is swinging in terms of how we overall manage the disease. I think we are leaning toward understanding that the dopamine replacement therapy can unfortunately have some fairly severe side effects long term, and so we do want to continue to use it, but we maybe want to introduce surgery at an earlier stage so that we can find a good balance that then you can just kind of coast for several years. So that's the first thing to understand, is that, you know, the medicine can have some significant downsides as you use more and more of it, and it needs to be used responsibly in combination with other therapies like exercise and surgery, I think much earlier than people realize. Like, if you're not a gym rat and you get diagnosed with Parkinson's, you better become one pretty quick. And then again, realize that surgery is not an end stage therapy. It's actually an early to moderate stage therapy that is best utilized in the more moderate stages. It's not a rescue therapy by any means at the end stage. And then just as it's not all bad news, I just like to end on a positive, that there are some things that are associated with less Parkinson's. So let's just end on that positive.
Preventive medicine.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, because why cure it if we could prevent it, you know? And I just actually had this great talk with a gentleman who had a lot of chemical exposure and ended up being a young onset. And I think it's super important to let, you know, our young, especially male workers in heavily chemical fields like woodworking, like forestry, to know that it's been shown that wearing personal protective equipment when you're dealing with chemicals is protective against the bad effects that can cause Parkinson's. So, you know, you might be young and indestructible, and what does it matter to you? I'm in a giant cloud of chemical and who cares. Really take care of yourself. If you work in a field that has chemical exposure, you should be wearing personal protective equipment. And if your bosses don't like the sound of that, have them call me. Gloves, masks, and personal protective equipment in chemical fields have been shown to help prevent and lower the incidence of Parkinson's. We also see a fair amount with the use of well water. So, you know, I would encourage people in rural areas to consider using water that does not come from the ground. Unfortunately, in this area, we've got a lot of forestry, a lot of chemicals that are sprayed for agricultural reasons. Those tend to seep into groundwater, and we know that they are a risk factor. So people that tend to use Brita or use some other source of water rather than well water have a lower incidence of Parkinson's. Other things that can reduce your risk are people that exercise heavily. Triathletes have a lower incidence of Parkinson's than the general population. So exercise is never a bad thing, but it's certainly a good thing for you if Parkinson's runs in your family. Caffeine. I mean, my parents will never get Parkinson's, not in the history of the world. They drink so much coffee. High flavonoid foods, blueberries, cherries, kale, red cabbage. Flavonoids, caffeine, exercise, all factors that can reduce your risk of Parkinson's.
You know, you mentioned the early utilization of brain stimulation, which makes a lot of sense to me because, you know, if you can stimulate the receptor of that neuron, that terminal neuron that affects movement,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just spraying it with dopamine.
It's a little more selective.
A little bit more selective. So
yeah.
We always used to talk about excitotoxicity,
mm-hmm.
you know, in neurology. And,
right.
and we wonder, you know, if some of these medications don't actually accelerate the disease in some individuals that may be predisposed to that. So,
right.
you know, being a classically trained neurologist, we talked about, you know, the classical mm-hmm. neurologist, he'd meet the patient, follow the patient for about 25 years.
Yeah.
The patient would die. And then they would look at the patient's brain
mm-hmm.
and, you know, look at it microscopically and determine,
yep.
you know, what were the, you know, what were the changes that were noted. And that's how mm-hmm. we learned about Lewy bodies and things like
yeah.
that. So
yeah.
your homework, Dr. Wilden, when we come back next time, tell me what DBS does with Lewy bodies compared to medical management.
Yeah.
Because my guess is that there could be some good news there in the future with regards to, you know, how this disease
yeah.
progresses
yeah.
with regards to, you know, losing neurons.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Standpoint. Essential tremor. So, Wendy, what do you expect to hear from a patient that you think is going to be diagnosed with essential tremor? We've got maybe about, you know, 6 or 7 minutes we're going to spend on this topic, but I know it's an important one.
Yeah. So our typical essential tremor patient, again, they're pretty special and, you know, individual little patients. But typically what happens, and they'll say that, you know, hey, I don't have my tremor when I'm just sitting here. It's whenever I go to write or go to, you know, pull my coffee cup up to my face. That's typically what we'll hear from the essential tremors. A lot of times, too, is we'll hear, well, I'll have a, you know, shot of bourbon and my tremor gets better. It's like, okay, well, yeah, that's probably not the best treatment, but all right. You know, so those are things that typically will cue to me, like, it sounds like a, you know, ET, essential tremor patient.
Before we get too far into tremor, let's take our next caller. We have Susan from Long Branch. Susan, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
In fact, I think you're addressing something right now that I've been waiting to hear. My grandson, who's now 27, and he actually lives in the Dallas area. He does. I live in Long Branch, Texas, you know, close to Freeport here. I didn't know this until just recently. He said he started, his right hand started shaking when he was like in middle school. And now it has gotten worse and worse and worse. And now he's trying to find a doctor in Dallas to be tested. But he was visiting not too long ago, and actually there would be times when he would have to reach over with his left hand and hold his right hand still. And he has problems sleeping. He works at the computer. That's one of his jobs all day long. So I was just wondering about the essential tremor that yeah. I think that we're beginning to talk about.
Thank you so much for the call. We're going to see what Dr. Wilden thinks.
Yeah. So, you know, the 20s is pretty young for Parkinson's, so it sounds more like essential tremor. Just so we're clear on the differences between the two, they are both brain disorders sending a bad signal to the muscle, but essential tremor is more likely to be inherited in families. It's more likely to present in childhood or adolescence, and it's tremor with action. And so you can start, and it can be one hand worse than the other, but usually you have some involvement of both hands. And we just actually did surgery on a woman who was a waitress in her 20s, who had severe inherited essential tremor, and she's done quite well. So you can actually develop very severe forms of essential tremor, even very young. Tremor is typically most obvious when you're using your hands. So things like typing, using a mouse, writing, eating, drinking. Many patients will learn to compensate by grabbing their most affected hand with the other hand. We were just laughing in the background because one of our pictures in our handout is exactly that phenomenon where a patient uses their left hand to stabilize their right hand. It's a very common compensatory technique in essential tremor patients. And there are medicines for it. There are also surgical options for it. So, you know, unfortunately, it is the most common tremor disorder in the United States. And yet we hear all the time that doctors tell patients that there's nothing that can be done. And that is simply not the case. There are medicines and surgeries that can help you live a very full and rewarding life, even with essential tremor.
What are some of the medications that you typically use, Wendy, for treatment of essential tremor?
Great question. So our go-to is going to be a primidone and see how they tolerate that. If not, we can always go to a beta blocker like a propranolol and kind of go from there.
And you mentioned, you know, some of the symptoms that patients describe whenever there's an onset. How often do patients say that... you know, they're medicating their tremor with alcohol. Is there actually a risk of alcoholism in patients who have the disorder as a way of self-medicating?
Definitely, definitely. We see that, unfortunately, a lot because, again, they haven't been diagnosed or people say, oh, you can't be treated. So they treat themselves.
And what about, you know, other things that might stimulate, you know, the adrenergic system? It could increase the tremor. Should patients stay away from things like, you know, caffeine? And mm-hmm. you know,
that's an excellent idea. Yeah, they should stay away from nicotine, caffeine, you know, chocolate, unfortunately.
Or small doses.
Or small doses, yeah. Can't give up chocolate
all the
way.
You got to live.
But also they need to make sure that they're sleeping well. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of times they'll say at the end of the night it gets unbearable. You know, I can't do anything. You know, they're just... all over the place by the time, you know, it's time to go to sleep.
What about patients that have combination attention deficit disorder and essential tremor?
That's tough.
There's a curveball for you.
Yeah, that's why you need to see the Movement Disorder Center. So we can work with you and your psychiatrist and our psychologist to figure out a good option for you. I mean, everything like all diseases is about risk and benefit. You know, all the meds will have some risk to them, but if the benefit outweighs that, then we encourage you to use them. But essential tremor, if it's severe in your 20s, you should absolutely demand to get aggressive treatment. There's no reason someone like that should go on to disability for tremor when we have excellent therapies for it.
Now, you know, you mentioned botulinum toxin that you send some patients out mm-hmm. for. I know that it has been used in some cases of essential mm-hmm. tremor, especially, you know, the type that affects voice.
Right.
Speak to us a little
right.
bit about
yeah. So there are variants of essential tremor. Many essential tremor patients have tremor in the hands, obviously, but not all. Some people have more tremor in the voice or the head. Some people can have mainly head and vocal tremor. And those patients probably have a type of disease called dystonic tremor, which is slightly different from essential tremor. But and then finally, you have patients that just have mainly tremor in the legs when standing and no tremor in the head or the hands. So there are quite a few variants of essential tremor. The management principles are similar for the hand type, but botulinum toxin that can basically relax the vocal muscles so that they don't tremor as much.
much is really a useful therapy. Likewise, you can do Botox basically in the neck and the head area to calm down a head tremor, and that can be effective for many years. I've found personally that Botoxing the hands, patients haven't been super happy with that because it tends to make your hands weak as a side effect. And again, whereas your neck or your chin could be a little weak and maybe not bother you, your hand being weak is a bit tougher. So sometimes we'll refer, if the patient would like, to a specialist for hand Botox, but many patients are a little hesitant, rightly so, about that.
Let's quickly go to the last caller we'll be able to take tonight. We have Jerry from Shreveport. Jerry, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
I was just going to ask the doctor, what kind of surgery would you need for Parkinson's?
It's too bad we're wrapping up. Just kidding. So basically the big picture, Jerry, is that Parkinson's is an abnormal brain rhythm, similar to how you can have an abnormal heart rhythm. And the surgery we offer is a brain pacemaker. So it's actually very similar in appearance to a heart pacemaker, but the lead, instead of going into the heart, will go through the skull and into the brain to the area that controls your movement. And this brain pacemaker, it takes about 3 hours to put in. You are under general anesthesia. And it's a great way. It sort of acts like a long-acting medicine in the background to improve your general mobility, your tremors, and your stiffness. Maybe you couldn't get in and out of bed before. Maybe you had to give up some hobbies. And maybe the brain pacemaker can bring some of that back.
Have you used deep brain stimulation for essential tremor as well?
Oh, yeah. Deep brain stimulation works for essential tremor, too. So, yeah, they're just, the brain pacemaker is a great option to add to your toolbox to fight these brain diseases. It is grossly underused across this region. I really encourage people. We do not sign you up for surgery on your first visit. We are information only. Please come talk to us so you know all your options. There is so much out there that can be done for these problems and help you live a better and bigger, fuller life. Please don't accept that there's nothing more that can be done and hang your head and live a sad life, because we have so many options to live just an excellent full life with Parkinson's or essential tremor.
And that was Dr. Jessica Wilden, neurosurgeon at Tri-State Neurosurgery. And speaking of informational purposes only, Health Matters actually is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show will be available for download from redriverradio.org. Views expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Phone assistance tonight has been provided this evening by Mr. Wally Derleth, as well as Ms. Sheila Lawrence. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and please join us next Thursday for another episode of Health Matters. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.